Lots of interesting issues. My gosh. Wow.
Mm.
So I have unfortunately nothing to disclose, and I don't have a slide saying so, but you'll have to take my word for it. Anyway, university-based program to increase professional capacity to address the global road safety epidemic. The kind of narrative of this in four or five statements is the developed countries are beginning to successfully address road safety issues. By almost any rate, per population, per vehicle, per licensed driver, per vehicle mile traveled, are coming down. The rates are coming down in all European countries, U.S., Canada, Australia, so on. However, I should hasten to say that the burden is still unacceptably high. And of course, now the aim is towards zero deaths. And many of these countries have adopted that as a goal. Well, the big however here is that in developing countries, roadway injuries and deaths are increasing at an alarming rate. Again, almost any way you measure it, absolute numbers, per population, per mile traveled, and so forth, per vehicle. And one of the issues that we're addressing here, or one of the issues in this, is that in developing countries, the capacity just does not exist to address these issues. In the U.S. and European countries, the last 60 or 70 years has been spent developing capacity for engineers, planners, in enforcement structures, and so forth. Well, our project, UC Berkeley, offers a resource to assist in developing capacity to address these issues in what we're calling developing countries worldwide. So, the global burden of road injury. This is actually a newsletter we did about 6 or 8 years ago. Our center, by the way, has been in existence since year 2000. And previous to 2000, I did research in epidemiology of heart disease and cancer and all sorts of things. And through a couple of happenstances, you know, people bring in a research project and then you spend an idea and you spend the rest of your life on it, the rest of your career, sort of an interesting thing that happens. But so I got interested in road safety and we got some funding to develop a center there. I'm going to talk a little bit about it. But that's our newsletter. We've been interested in this issue of global safety for quite a while. More than 3,000 people per day die from traffic injury around the world. 85% in low and middle income countries, and mostly pedestrians, bicyclists, and motorcyclists. More than half these victims are young, and the costs, well, I've estimated $65 billion, but I'm sure it's higher than that. There are no real way to identify the monetary impact, but it's got to be enormous. This is a chart showing for various countries the distribution of type of we're calling road safety victims in this slide. And you can see, first of all, there's a very wide variation in the mode. Mm-hmm. So, for example, let's take the U.S., which is the fifth one down. You can see that motorized four-wheelers constitute the large majority. In fact, it's around 80% of the road fatalities and also injuries. And in the U.S., about 12% are pedestrians and 2 or 3% are bicyclists. And then there's motorized two-wheelers, motorcycles, basically in the U.S. The picture is dramatically different in a number of other countries. First of all, in European countries, it's somewhat similar to the U.S. But let's take, for example, Malaysia, where motorized two-wheelers are about 60%. Motorized four-wheelers, that is what we're calling vehicles, are maybe 12 or 15%. India, mostly pedestrians. In fact, it has the highest proportion of pedestrians injuries in this particular set of countries. And you can see bicyclists and motorized four-wheelers. Of course, these patterns are beginning to change quite a bit. What's basically happening in the developing countries is that vehicles are entering environments where people have mostly walked, biked, had various modes of transportation for millennia, and suddenly these areas are being flooded with automobiles. We were recently at a conference in Delhi. I don't have pictures, but many of you have seen scenes of traffic around the world. And in the city of, this was a conference, by the way, on road safety, and the whole thrust of this was how are we going to reduce fatalities and on the roadway, and how are we going to control the automobile? That was the theme. As you can imagine, this was a certain type of, you know, public health population. But on that, in Delhi, every single day, 500 new automobiles enter the city, are purchased, and enter the streets. And I'm sure most of you have seen the scenes where there is vehicle traffic, there are pedestrians walking everywhere, there are bicyclists everywhere, scooters, and in the case of some parts of Delhi and outside, cows, camels, sometimes on freeways. And so it's a very chaotic situation. There are some people that look at the scene and you can see no collisions, you know, as you're watching, and we were driven around and didn't see any. But we really don't have rates. We really don't know the situation very well. Some people say, well, with all this mix of traffic, everybody knows that everyone else is there and they adjust. I don't think this is the case exactly. So we need better statistics on exactly what the rates are as a function of exposure. But we do know that the sheer burden of injury and fatality is rising in these and many other areas. Well, globally, there's actually a number of sort of the Burden of Disease Project by the World Health Organization, Harvard, has developed these measures, you know, for example, called disability-adjusted life years, and I think most of you know about that sort of measure where you can compare different kinds of outcomes, compare, you know, across years and so forth in terms of the burden of disease on a population. And road traffic fatalities in 2004, according to this particular graph study, was ninth and is projected to go to five in 2030. Some analyses suggest that it's going to go even higher. So disability-adjusted life years, of course, takes into account fatality, but also injury or other events earlier in life, and these are weighted and so forth. So, this is just another representation comparing deaths, not disability-adjusted life years. 1.3 million deaths globally compared to AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, in this case. Globally, just under half of these are non-car occupants and non-other, and others a sort of miscellaneous category. There are many deaths where it's not clear what the mode was. So the global response, and there has been a very vigorous global response to this. The World Bank and the World Health Organization both have fairly major programs to address the issue. For example, the United Nations declared the Decade of Action for Road Safety from 2011 to 2020. I think May 2011 and then 10 years thereafter will be a focus through conferences, research, and so on. The TRB has established a Global Road Safety Subcommittee that we participate in. There have been a number of reports. If you just look on the internet, UN Secretary General, various kinds of, World Bank, various NGOs and so forth, there is scheduled to be a second UN Global Road Safety Week, April 2013. So that's coming up if you want to plan, plan events around that. So what is the need? Now, obviously, there are lots of needs. Where we come in, we think, is to address a particular need for road safety expertise. The bureaucratic and physical structure for maintaining safety has quite simply failed to keep pace with rapid motorization. So there's an urgent need for engineers, researchers, planners, policymakers, public health officials, program planners again, and I might add evaluation specialists, and I might add enforcement personnel. So also the corresponding laws and structures and regulations and practices, best practices that are associated with each of these professions. So that's where we think we come in. We have an existing program called SafeTrack, and basically I'm going to tell you about that in just a second, but we're proposing, we've currently focused primarily on the U.S., and our funding comes from U.S. Agencies and other grant sources. But our proposal is for pre- and postdoctoral researchers and visiting scholars to come to Berkeley from around the world, that we would develop funding sources to support these, provide them with courses and training and research opportunities. Now, our research center, as I said, has been in existence since the year 2000. We do research, education, technical support. We have a website and so forth. We teach two graduate-level courses, one in public health on injury prevention and control, and another on transportation safety. It's actually traffic safety, planning for traffic safety, that we teach in the spring. And we've taught these courses now for about 12 years and reached hundreds of students through that. Our general concept, education, data tools, research, we do lots of geocoding, mapping, lots of data stuff. We have institutional connections of one sort or another with a number of universities and research groups around the world. It's kind of difficult keeping up, by the way, with. And we've also had visiting scholars. This is really just a partial list of, all of you know that this is really now international, that injury control and prevention is truly international. And we really kind of came across this idea or began to develop this because most of our students now are international. I have a class now, I'm teaching in public health injury, and everybody has fairly recent connections to other countries beside the U.S. And it's just an amazingly diverse group. So our idea is that in some ways we already have a global road safety training program. We just don't have funding to support that per se. We have other funding for research. Lots of our scholars bring money with them. For example, China has a very extensive program where they send visiting scholars to Berkeley and other places, and they fully support them. And anyway, UCB resources, we have transportation engineering, city and regional planning, and so forth. We have a number of schools and centers that already have a global focus, and we have collaborations with a number of these. So Institute of Transportation Studies, we're probably most, even though my affiliation is the School of Public Health, we're most closely affiliated with something called the Institute of Transportation Studies, which is connected to civil engineering primarily. And in fact, it's a little bit ironic. We're from public health, or I am, out of that background. But the people in transportation, I can't get people in public health interested in injury, even less so in traffic injury. I can't figure that out. it's the number one killer in the United States of young people from about 2 or 3 to 24. Number one, it's going to be, and it already is, a major impact on global health. And in public health, people say, well, isn't that a engineering thing? Well, yeah. There's also the driver. There's also, so. But anyway, so most of our students are from the Institute of Transportation Studies and from city and regional planning, probably 80% of them. So, you know, we have Transportation Sustainability Research Center, UCTC, that we're very closely affiliated with, Global Metropolitan Studies, Center for Global Public Health. This is in public health. And maybe, some of you may be familiar with some of these programs, Center of Evaluation for Global Action and so forth. So basically, here are some photos of scenes from around the world, but basically we feel we have the context where we can create, we call it a global road safety network. We started with that idea. We decided to pull back and call it a training center instead. We don't want to get too, it got really overwhelming, you know, the connections you can make and the people around the world that are interested in collaboration. So one kind of issue, business plan, well, okay, the funding, of course. One issue, I don't know if this is an issue or not. People come to Berkeley or to other universities from around the world, at least half of them, a large percentage of them end up staying in the U.S., right? So we bring people here with the idea of, well, okay, they can get trained in engineering, planning, and so forth, and go back. I'm not saying this is good or bad or anything like that. They often maintain connections in the country that they came from. But that's one issue when one is thinking about bringing people here for training. An alternative is to provide training in that country. And that's a number of programs are aimed in that way, and that's one of the mechanisms that we'll be working on also. So thank you. I think my time's up. Thank you.
Thanks very much, and I want to talk to you afterward because we have a road safety guy up at University of Washington, and I'm sure would like to hook up with you, Charlie Mock. So we have another 10 minutes for discussion and questions.
I have a question.
Yes.
One factor in reduced mortality from traffic injuries in this country was enforcement over drinking laws and increasing or making sure we don't reduce the legal drinking age. And by dealing much, this is the way to tie in the public health community, of this major factor of drink driving and also drink walking, people are going, they're not going to be. Are you dealing with that? That's a major factor. Because you get a double whammy there.
In the United States, yes. Of course, that the success over reducing DUI is one of the major public health events in the last 30 years. Right. And it's triggered from the grassroots organization, almost entirely, which is really quite interesting. But globally, the issues are so wide and broad, and that would be one. We don't actually know. We don't have the data to know the degree and the percentage of global fatalities that are health involved. It's certainly very high. By the way, in California, one of our programs we administer is by the checkpoint program for the state.
Great, good question. Let's see, go over here, there, and there.
Previous presentations on motivation, intrinsic motivation, how one trains and things like that, and that of course is relevant.
Great. And, yeah. Hi, I have a question for all of the panelists, actually. I'm at a university and we're looking to ramp up our workforce development programs and training. But it's always hard to determine where to start, where to begin. And especially when faculty are spread so thin with research and many other obligations. So for those of you who have worked, who are either from a university or who have worked with university partners, what are best practices that you've used or encountered in trying to develop workforce, global workforce development programs and initiatives?
Best practices? Well, we have kind of a situation where people come from around the world anyway. And, but issues we have are, I mean, you probably all know about these issues. There's issues with passports and visas and a whole bunch of just that stuff that we actually spend a fair amount of time on. And then, of course, there's funding. And we find that the people who come are usually highly motivated. And they need assistance in things like visas and also support.
Construct the
$10 program. Yes. Yeah. And I think the other thing is you need faculty and school and department support for this. In other words, they need to be able to be enrolled in courses, a lot of them, develop relationships with professors and researchers and to help integrate them into the university in this particular case.
And certainly the kind of workforce development that, you know, they've heard described. A lot of it does focus on a very specific, you know, area of the health workforce, so family planning or HIV or, you know, sort of traffic safety, and that tends to be, I think it's easier to get funding for a very specific issue. It's not ideal, of course, because, well, staff being explaining a lot of areas, but that tends to be something to push back here. And then,
questions for a couple of people, but the motivation study. I can't remember the percentage of male community-based health workers, but it's 61% or something of that sort. I'm wondering, I don't think you address gender differences in motivations, and the other question is, how do your findings compare to the work in microfinance women as motivations to set up their own enterprises, because we've been looking at micro-franchising and job creation in the community-based health workforce area, and I'm just curious about that.
There were no gender differences. You're right. There, 61% of the sample were male, but when we controlled for gender, we didn't see any distinction. So we only talked today about the significant findings and we didn't see any around gender, which I think was surprising. It's hard to generalize whether or not this would be applicable to a microfinance team, but if we learned anything from the performance-based incentive teams that use financial motivators, I think that the literature shows that the process of engaging in saving clubs or microfinance initiatives, it's not just the fact that you have access to a greater amount of financial capital than you had before, but those feelings about autonomy, control over destiny, being able to have the resources to chart development is an equally important part of that. So my guess is that there would be applicability.
So the desire for promotion finding was not related to extra financial compensation?
No, it was about, you know, and I think if we think back, you know, in our own lives, you get a $10,000 salary increase, but you know that your ability to progress in terms of responsibility in your current organization is stymied and that you don't have that ability to take on greater challenges and greater responsibilities, it is demotivating and it doesn't sort of compensate the fact that you've got some extra salary increases.
Yeah, so recognition, the idea of recognition, feeling useful and feeling
I'm sorry. I wanted to know if you're measuring quality of living situation, so instead of what the additional means of compensation or incentive is to provide some housing or boarding water, whatever the amenities would be of the work situation, if that improved the...
So what we did was we looked at satisfaction with additional benefits, which included things like housing allowances, paid time off. We didn't drill deeply or aggregate at sort of a housing allowance versus fixed time or these different types of benefits. But one thing that we did see is that there was a difference with satisfaction of absolute levels of compensation and satisfaction with additional benefits. So you saw far more people who were dissatisfied with their absolute level of compensation than they were with their additional benefits. So more people were satisfied with their benefits, and there's less of a strong relationship between the benefits and the intrinsic motivation. So with the financial compensation, you saw a very strong negative association. With additional benefits, you saw a negative association, but it was not statistically significant.
Any other questions? Maybe I have one more.
On the transportation aspect, you were saying why can't you get interest? And I'm involved with the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disability aspect of things. There's a lot of transportation focus, injury prevention discussion among the subset of people involved with that. But if you look at most global health conferences that I attend, they're typically on mortality reduction. They are not about morbidity. And it's more recently, I think, that we see focus on morbidity. And disability has been vastly ignored over the years. And now, currently, because 154 countries signed the treaty and the 119 have ratified, there is an effort on national disability planning. So the whole issue of injury and accident, having been in India and watched people on bikes get hit by the bus we were riding on, and people just waved to the guy who was hit. I've seen that. But I think that you might find some synchronicity with perhaps some discussion with the disability section here, and certainly with the larger international community that's working on synchronizing public health plans and health care plans and e-health plans with the national disability planning that's happening. So that's one factor. But you didn't mention online learning as one, or certificate programs as one option to address brain drain by people coming to the States or UK or wherever they stay. And, we think technology applications offer some opportunities to address brain gain in developing countries without coming in and just doing short-term workshops that often don't sustain it over time, where you can do ongoing mentoring using technology. Are you considering some of this?
Yes. The answer to both your questions is yes. In California, the ADA lawsuit to trigger Caltrans to set up a whole database of sidewalks and other facilities in the state army system. And that, of course, is going to benefit all pedestrians and bicycles. And so that is a point of leverage. And with regard to online resources and education, yes, I think that would be a major conduit.
I'd like to thank all of you for coming, and also our presenters for some really fabulous presentations, giving you all some additional ideas and thoughts and information now about the workforce area. So thanks very much, and I think maybe they'll be able to stick around a little bit longer if you have any additional questions. So thanks to everybody.